Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Cenovus.com.
This is One Heat Minute.
Drop of a hat, these guys will rock and roll.
What's your name?
Wayne Bro.
Look like gangbangers working the local 7-Eleven. Robbery, homicides, take it.
Give me all you got! Give me all you got!
I do what I do best. I take scores. You do what you do best. I'm trying to stop guys like you.
A podcast dedicated to all 170 minutes of Michael Mann's LA crime opus Heat, 1 minute at a time. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to One Heat Minute. I'm your host, Blake Howard, and joining me a full 109 episodes after his last appearance on the show, a friend of mine. You would have heard us talk about rage reversing and being cool enough not to actually greet someone when they ring you on the phone. He's heard on ABC. He writes for publications such as Birth, Movies, Death, SBS, 10 Daily, The Guardian, The Monthly, Vice. And we started a little website together called Graffiti with Punctuation now like 7 or 8 years ago. Jesus H. Crikey. The man himself, Mr. Cam Williams. Welcome back to 1 8 Minute, my friend. How are you?
I'm good now, Blake. I hope you're paying attention while I'm talking, but what I want is I want a cream cheese bagel. I want a Coca-Cola. I'm just in this real power position right now where I expect people to listen as soon as I start talking, as if I'm picking up a phone
no
and
greeting.
Commanding respect.
Not a greeting. Tell me Albert Tarina called back, but you got to have that. You got to do that. And look, you're in a position of power because right now you've just, you know, you've seen Justine's power play. We're here at the 133rd minute. You've seen Justine for little Vincent with Ralph. You're seeing the tail end of their devastating sort of final fight in this movie. Yeah, you're right here, man. We're right in the home stretch.
Yeah, this is Endgame. That's the thing I kept whispering to myself watching this minute. I was like, I kept saying, Endgame. I was like, because... I've mentioned this before, but I'm just so in awe of your ability to pick this podcast to do about one of the longest films. when you really do break it down per minute, this marathon, that the fact that we're now at this point in the film where things are really, you know, things have happened and escalated, and you know, now we're breaking it all down in terms of how everyone's getting out. It kind of puts it all in perspective and just makes you more in awe of the ability to kind of set everything up. And then now, you know, this deep into this saga, it's now, oh, this is how everyone is getting out. And this is how all these relationships are ending and things are breaking down. Pacino with the television, I was just like, this is such, we've spent so much time with this character now that him walking out with that TV just makes sense. You totally agree with that decision.
It's a heartbreaking thing. It's funny, like, you know, it's so funny that that's the one thing that he temporarily even gives the slightest shit about. It's not even his clothes. He just doesn't care. He's just like, you can't take my... And this is the tragedy of this whole movie, I think, like it just escalates. And I think you're right. Like this is the fallout of all of the middle of the heist and all of these relationships falling down and the end game is here. But like the desperation and tragedy of a character that he's just like, this is my one little oasis that I visit every night after my really horrible, shitty day, because my profession that both drives me and inspires me also like torments me. And this guy's watching my TV is way more perverse than you sleeping with him. Like, it's just so sad. Yeah. It's really sad.
Yeah, it is. So, and even looking back to the previous minutes that we did, there was a very similar scene across minutes 23 and 24 that we did previously where there was this kind of conversation going on. And I think on the episodes that we did, you and I discussed kind of like what possessions he would have brought to that house with him.
Yes.
As a cop in his position. because he constantly is referencing throughout the film, you know, the fact that he's living in this crazy designed house.
Dead
that
tech, postmodern bullshit house. Yep, that exact thing.
which is great. Which, like, throughout this film, whenever you see the home life of Hannah, I always just think about, like, what possessions does he own? What, like, does he have, like, two
one.
Suits? Like,
his
one.
Suits.
Just like,
he's got the TV, yeah. Honestly, and clothes. And, like, and a glorious gold chain. Just before we dive into this minute, now, folks who are listening to this, we're recording it a little earlier than you guys are going to be hearing it. You're going to be hearing this about the 27th of March in Aussie time, so around then internationally. And I saw a great tweet that I wanted to reference to you because we were talking about his only possessions that he'll be having. Now, I saw someone talking about Vincent Hannah, I just want to get her name, Gabriella Paella. It's at GMPAIELLA, and she goes, I can't remember if there's a scene at the beginning of Heat where Al Pacino is kissing really gross and weird, or if it's falsely implanted on my memory, but either way, I think about it all the time. And in that moment, at the beginning of this movie, the only other thing I can think of is his possessions, his clothes, his television, and just the gold chain that's around his neck is literally everything that Vincent Hanna owns in this house. He does not own another thing going on.
Yeah, he doesn't. And I assume that everything else is just work issue. So he's probably, like, you know, the phone he has, his gun, like most of his possessions he probably gets from work, which makes me think that, like, you know, it just shows you that everything in his life is in debt to his chosen profession, which at some point you have to think that he was like, well, if I become a cop, I've got an excuse to wear the same suit all the time, because no one ever questioned that decision. So, like, maybe, yeah, his profession is by choice, purely out of necessity, and that no one will ever question your general well-being and probably living in squalor, you know, because you're wearing the same suit all the time and you're kind of getting around eating crappy food and drinking a lot. Maybe by choice that was a decision he made in the very beginning, that he would become a cop and he would live this kind of small lifestyle. You know, it's very much that, you know, that.
I think you've drawn the great parallel that we haven't really talked about in the, and we haven't even started this minute. So what we're going to do, we're going to pause. I've got a thought for you, Mr. Cam Williams, before we get into this. But let's dive into this minute right now. 133rd minute, if you guys are watching on the original theatrical cut of the Warner Brothers edition of the Heat Blu-ray. You're at exactly 2 hours and 12 minutes. That is the 133rd minute. It's at the tail end of the Ralph scene with Justine and Vincent, sort of at that coda, and then begins a wonderful little exchange between De Niro's Neil and Nate, John Voight. So Cam and I are going to quickly watch it together. Then we're going to come back and we can dive into, I think, some more great points that Cam brings up around just, we've talked so many times on this podcast about Neil being this Spartan guy who wears exactly the same suit, who only has two coffee mugs in his entire house, doesn't appear to have any kind of worldly possessions. And that's kind of that overemphasized, you know, in his life, because he doesn't, you know, Edie doesn't interact with his space. But here with Vincent, we get distracted by the sort of accoutrement of, like, Justine's previous life and not realize it until exactly what you start saying now. It's like when you start seeing him pack up in this scene, he's holding one thing, the one thing that he likes, which is his TV, his little escape. But let's check out this minute and then we'll come back and we'll deep dive into this bad boy.
Passports, driver's checks, plastic. The plane, charter terminal, LAX, hangar 17. Call it as a 1011 Sierra. Hushes down. Holds for you. 5 minutes, then splits. The plane will stand an FAA check. File flight plan that works.
And where's Chris?
He's gone.
What?
Said he's going on his own. Went to look for Charlene.
Didn't you bring him here?
Yeah, I brought him here.
What happened?
free country, brother. Check in with me, 9. Everything's still cool.
One of those great minutes where it ends seemingly perfectly, like we just planned it to end exactly where it did.
It meant to be. It's almost as if Michael Mann made this film thinking, one day I reckon someone's going to break this down minute by minute. This is my masterpiece.
Oh, man. If I wouldn't put it past him to be that meticulous to know that, you know, to sort of preempt and plan people's attention spans a minute at a time. But no, this is a great little scene. Vincent walking out the coda, like, just I love when you catch a coda of a scene like we just saw at the beginning. You just see Vincent kind of like in disarray, and you see Justine sort of purposeful or sort of stoic with like, I had to set fire to this thing the only way that I could get your attention, and here we are, this is it. And then we get to Neil and Nate, this great fraternal relationship, standing right here on these steps and at the front of the back of his bar. And another rage acceleration behind this thing that scared someone instead of Krisha Hillis. It's just unrandom.
Yeah, that made me think, is there another heat going on at a different pace in the background of this film? And so we're seeing, that scene that rage accelerate. Which is, a very masculine thing, when you're angry in traffic, it's like, oh, I'm just going to get around these people by rage accelerating around them to let them know how much they've annoyed me, which kind of in this scene is very much used to kind of find that tension and make you feel like these characters are so on edge that, like, even just like someone, rage accelerating in the background makes them think that something's about to happen. Like a really nice little touch in that scene that, it's only a small bit in the film, but, once you're kind of thinking about everything, the end game again, thinking about how everything's kind of falling apart and, who's going to get out and who's not, these characters are so on edge that even just little things happening in the background are like setting them off and they're reacting accordingly.
Yeah, I like that little flurry. Some people have had the theory in previous episodes of the show that, like, they're like, is that Vincent? Like, is Justine's house near Nate's bar? And it's not Vincent.
Oh, yeah.
It's not Vincent. I had it very aptly pointed out by a Heat fan. Thank you so much again, guys. I'm just going to quickly jump into it right in the middle of the show, which is like mail@oneheatminute.com and Twitter @BlakeIsBatman, because a couple of people, when we floated the theory that might very well be Vincent, they're like, we're quick to point out, this is car experts and I'm not a car guy. They're like, no, he drives a different car than that. They're just like, no, it's a different car. And if Michael Mann knows what car Vincent drives, so... if it was that little rage reversing or rage, streaming past Nate's thing, could be that. But then the other theory is maybe it's Ralph getting the hell out of Justine's place. Like, oh, I see her. I just have been threatened and
well, in the heat, in the world of Heat, you have to assume that everyone is on the run or like, because the heat is constantly coming for you. So you can never, like, even if you're just going out to get milk, like, you're going to be like speeding off because time is precious and you've got to constantly stay on the move. So I just assume that in this world, everyone is constantly just like driving really fast everywhere, probably talking on their phone.
Maybe.
Yeah. It's one of those things, but, I have to say, John Voight.
Yes.
I did a lot of John Voight research. I did a crazy amount of research on John Voight just for this minute, because watching this scene, it really did remind me where John Voight's career was at when he did Heat. And I looked through his kind of IMDb profile and just kind of trying to figure out what he was actually doing at the time. But there wasn't a lot of stuff prior to Heat that I could really kind of pin down and say, oh yeah, that was a great John Voight performance. But then you look at him post Heat, he's in everything. He does Mission Impossible straight after Heat, which makes me think, how much of a resurgence this was for him and how much of a big deal, I guess, at the time it would have been, not only to see, we've talked about this previously about how, the film was very much promoted as, the Pacino, De Niro together film.
Yes.
But, even just the appearance of, like a kind of like a Hollywood legend like John Voight, who kind of seemed to have been in the woods a little bit prior to this.
I think you're forgetting. Yeah, I know you want to say this so much, but what was the thing that he did in 1994 playing himself that we're both absolutely unbelievable fans of that possibly kicked off his resurgence in the minds?
So my theory is that the Voight explosion that happened in the 90s that kind of began a little bit with Heat, but prior to that, I think his appearance on Seinfeld in the episode where George buys a car and thinks that it's John Voight's car.
Amazing.
Which then leads to an incredible cameo where John Voight bites Kramer on the arm. That was probably the most significant. That's probably how I learned who John Voight was through that episode. Because I wouldn't like at the time that came out, I wouldn't have seen any of his previous films at all. Unless someone had told me, and also being quite young at the time. So in the 90s, you know, John Voight was the guy from Seinfeld and the guy from Heat.
Yes.
I love
a deep dive on an actor's IMDb profile for this movie, but you just have a look at it, like 1969 Midnight Cowboy, 70 Catch 22, 72 Deliverance. Holy shit. Like 79 The Champ. That's probably like, it's probably his top 4-5 movies ever, like all in that time. And you're totally right. There's a huge sidestep in his career. He does a couple of TV movies and things like that, TV miniseries. And then Heat comes around, and it's funny, like the story goes that John Voight always said to Michael Mann, and I think we're probably going to dive into it, but he always said to Michael Mann that when he was reading this on the page, he's like, I don't know why you want me for this. He goes, you know, knowing your style, you just pick, you know, instead of picking an actor that does this role, you pick the guy who is this in real life. You know, you end up picking someone who was a crook in real life to play this part, because it's not a huge part. It's an important part, but it's not a huge part of the movie. And Michael Mann said something which I think is great. And he's like, but yeah, well, then we'd never get to work together. And so it's just such a nice little, oh, well, that kick-started it. And then you're right. He hits Mission Impossible, does the incredible, some would call incredible or insane Anaconda, an equally insane U-turn. Then he's in Enemy of the State, Rainmaker, Varsity Blues, a lot of strong 90s content in there.
And also there is watching the changing of the baton in the 4x100 relay at the Olympic Games. There's something incredible about John Voight going from Michael Mann to Brian De Palma, yes, from Heat to Mission Impossible.
Yes.
In terms of, you know, your dream transition between directors and actors kind of making a resurgence in Hollywood, that is so good for, especially, you know, for Voight's career. But the fact that he kind of reemerges in Heat and then becomes quite prominent in Mission Impossible and then beyond, and then even now he's kind of in the woods again, because he kind of says a lot of crazy things and yes, doing a lot of strange things, but which we must not get into, because, you know, it's a kind of a trashy digression. But that's what stands out for me the most here, and it's not stunt casting at all. It like you said, it very much was an excuse for Mann to get him in the film and, you know, play that role of the fence, which now we know in so many movies is just kind of that performance that people kind of do in their sleep, where they're kind of just doing these huge info dumps and they're kind of explaining things and they're setting up the plot. You know, whereas I think in this minute you really get to see that, you know, Voight not only brings a lot to a really small role, but that incredible line where he says it's a free country just shows you that, like, even, you know, a scene like this could have easily ended up on the cutting room floor because it is so full of kind of exposition, but Mann makes it matter. And, you know, he throws in that accelerating car to put you on edge, and then he's kind of, you know, he's doing the info dump and then he's kind of giving you important information. I think also too, De Niro in this scene, he has these really great reactions in this scene where he's surprised by what he's hearing.
Yeah, I think you nail that. The importance of the scene is what John Voight brings to it, and the importance of the character is what he brings to it, is because the relationship and the dynamic between these two, the power dynamic is much, you know, a couple of times we've talked about it being like fraternal or like brothers, like an older and younger brother relationship, because he heeds Nate's advice probably more than anyone, and he'll listen to Nate's advice. And there's not the same balance of power that you see in a lot of the choices and in a lot of the interpersonal relationships that are in this movie. There's usually, you know, even happens with Vincent, there's like dominant people, and then there's people who are hierarchically reporting to him, and then there's where he's contending for power in different scenes in his own personal relationship. And in every single Nate scene, albeit except the one that you don't really see them together, which is a phone call in the upcoming tunnel scene, like, he's listening and heeding Nate's advice to a point. He's hearing him. Sometimes he doesn't let it cut through or let it like penetrate what his purpose is. But in this scene, like, I think you're so right. Like, that it's a free country line is like one for the ages, because it just levels Neil. Like, he stops. There's genuine emotion, genuine care, genuine concern. Like, what? Like, he left. Like, I'm trying to get this guy out of here. And also for Neil, like, his effectiveness of delivering that news to Chris while he's lying down on that table, like, completely looking like shit in Jeremy Piven's dodgy doctor's office, of, like, think about that. Like, think about whether Charlene is really or out. Like, he was immovable. And so there's this kind of, like, pain and respect, and also respect for Nate, because if he wants to go, he's got to go. I'm not going to make him stay. I don't control him. It's free country, brother. Like, this is what it is. And it's like, that's maybe an extra few years of being experienced in the world where Nate's a bit more like sage wisdom. Like, this is where, like, Nate's most Obi-Wan Kenobi moment. Like, he just dropped, like, Neil is like the grumpy Luke Skywalker. Like, you know, he's just like, no, it's a free country, bro. He can do whatever he wants.
Yeah, exactly. And something that surprised me looking into this was, I did not realize that John Voight's character was based on a real guy named Eddie Bunker, who apparently wrote like a seminal book that Michael Mann referenced. And, you know, I don't know how much of this is true. So Michael Mann has to come on this podcast to clarify it. But apparently Bunker wrote a book called No Beast So Fierce that That's apparently right. was like mandatory reading on the set of Heat.
That's right.
For anyone that was kind of participating. And apparently he also he's credited as a technical consultant on the film, and I didn't dive too deeply into who Bunker was, but apparently he was like a career criminal who kind of had a lot of experience you know, in kind of the world that Mann was trying to replicate in Heat, in terms of the relationship between crooks and fixers and fences and all of these, or even that terminology, like something that, you know, I had no idea about, but kind of really capturing the authenticity of this world and how people interact with each other if they're on the wrong side of the law. So I'm very keen to kind of to look up more about this and even read the book.
Oh, the book is excellent. The book is excellent. You're so right. And how much people ever read the book or like dived into it, but like apparently it was Mann's like required reading for all of the crooks. So the De Niro, Kilmer, Sizemore, Kevin Gage and Hayes Burt, and working around, you know, and Bunker working with the guys on Heat, like as their technical advisor, and gang life just in general. Some really great, like, I don't know if it's dodgy IMDb trivia. So firstly, cool trivia, and for everyone to know, is like Eddie Bunker is in Reservoir Dogs. He's like the Mr. I'm going to find out which Mr. Color he is. I always forget which one it is off the top of my head. He's Mr. Blue. He's like the only guy when you watch Reservoir Dogs and you're like, who the hell is that guy? Like, because everyone else is a recognizable actor. He's like Mr. Blue, and he's adding that like level of authenticity to everything that's happening. And so, yeah, he's No Beast So Fierce, a seminal crime novel, hugely popular, came even to Australia, I hear. I've heard from a real like avid, you know, cinephile and just a voracious reading friend of mine, an older friend of mine, who has like, apparently bought Eddie Bunker's book on a crime bookstore that used to be in Glebe, when it first came out. Like, he got his hands on it and he said it was amazing. And this is the great IMDb trivia that, like, I don't actually know if it exists, but it's amazing if it did. Apparently he met Danny Trejo in Folsom Prison in the late 1970s.
Whoa.
And they became mates, and that's part of the reason why Trejo got a gig in Heat, is because they knew each other.
That is incredible.
Yeah. So yeah, like the basis, and that's what I mean about John Voight talking when he said, he'd known about Eddie Bunker, or Edward Bunker, is his name, and he's like, he's reading this thing about this guy who knows fences in and out, and you know, knows the criminal underworld and does all these jobs, and he's like, why don't you just get this guy to play him? And even Voight, if you look at Edward Bunker, like the moustache and sort of the long mullety hair at the time, like that's Eddie Bunker's look. And so Voight's even sort of adopting the look and looking a bit like, you know, not characteristically beautiful, striking, handsome John Voight. He's kind of got a bit of miles on him. That's Edward Bunker's look. So yeah, really, really interesting. He's just like, no, he's got to be the guy. You've got to be my man.
And even just Googling, like, if you just pop in like John Voight Heat, like one of the most common questions that pops up that they try to answer is John Voight's character and he based on a real person. So even like for years, people have been popping that into a search engine and trying to find out if this is a real guy. Because I guess people are just so fascinated by how much authority he kind of wields in the film. And, you know, he's this kind of like this wise, like you mentioned, kind of person that's always like giving the advice and you kind of listening to see if anyone's going to take it or what kind of like... Also, reading between the lines in that weird way that I guess in Heat, all the criminals are kind of always talking in code, or they're always talking in ways that it's like if you're on the right frequency of these people, you'll be understanding what they're talking about. And so throughout the film, kind of, you know, Nate is like that. He's kind of like talking to these characters in like, you know, kind of code. And if they don't get it, it's like almost life and death. It's like, this is what I'm telling you. And also, I guess a lot of it feeds into, I guess, the fact that these guys assume that they're always under surveillance. So they're always kind of talking code and they're always like having really boring, mundane conversations about like really intense things because they just never know who could be listening or who's ready to betray who or whatever. So like that's why I think that, like you mentioned, that devastating line of it's a free country is kind of like putting the biggest full stop ever on the entire relationship in terms of just saying like, hey, I'm no longer going to engage in talking about this at all. Which is really fascinating because that line very much could have come across as like a cliche or something in any other film because it's such an easy way out of an argument, such an easy way to kind of like when you're talking to someone go, hey, it's a free country.
It's a free country. Just in your head,
well, that person's an idiot.
I think the grace, like, and I mean like the grace of a performer to deliver what seems like a cliche line and make it really fresh and cool is everything, especially with an older performer. And I just think you're right about that. Like the most cliche BS line, it's a free country. Like it's a free country, man. Like how many times have you seen that in like badly written TV or a badly written movie? And him saying it's free country, brother. Like it just hits you like a ton of bricks. It's so perfect. And this is the other thing is he kind of preempts something. And it's something that I know that you and I maybe have talked about it in the context of like James Bond is like the projections of like high technical gadgets and whatnot in like the James Bond universe. And then it goes to lo-fi, like where they only want to have conversations. They only want to use a radio. It only wants to be a gun. And they make jokes about exploding pens. You know, there's that whole thing. And like in Heat and in particular in this scene, it's like, this information in modern movies would be delivered in a text message via a secure phone or a burner or, you know, something thing. And I just love some of the continued intimacy of like, Nate has done all this stuff where he's like used a landline to figure this shit out, book people in, but he doesn't really want to distill that information to anyone except face to face with Neil because he doesn't want any potential that if they're tracking him, that he's going to get caught. So it's like this cool, like, little detail of like, why does this scene exist? It goes to reinforce what you were saying before about why is this scene still in the movie? And one of the big things is like from a real pure like surveillance state and the evolution of the surveillance state perspective, it's like if he's face to face with him, just having a really quiet and intimate conversation with him, and they're at the back of his bar and they know that that's not under surveillance, then you're all good. Whereas like having it in like somewhere else potentially, or a new scene where someone could be following him or whatever, they control this little turn. So you see them having this really open and candid conversation. But to your point as well, the reaction shot of De Niro here, we sort of started to dive into it before he went back to John Voight as Nate. The reaction shot from when he's like, where's Chris? He's like, he's gone. He's the double take look that, and I've just paused it for Cam and I to watch while we're here talking to you guys. It's 37 seconds into this minute. He's just so puzzled. He's got this like hurt and puzzled face. Like what? Like he's gone. It's just, it's paired with that. And then Voight delivers the magic. Yeah. And you just watch him. What happened? It's a free country, brother. So good. It's like, what do you mean? Like, what happened? What do you want me to do? I'm not going to keep him here. Like, he's a guy who's all blown up to pieces. What happened? 48 seconds. Man, Voight's eyes in this scene right now are just, like, looking through him. Like, it's so great.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's amazing. And, you know, and I think the whole presence of Voight in this film only hit harder upon revisitation in putting his career in context at the time. Yes. So much of his appearance in this film, I think people would have just been like, John Voight, he's back. Where has he been?
Where's he been? Right.
And yeah, you know, like in the mid 90s, you couldn't really easily kind of dig up, unless you were like kind of a walking, talking like movie nerd, you couldn't really readily pull up that information that quickly. You kind of had to kind of assume that
the yearly Leonard Maltin like movie encyclopedia, like that I'm sure both of us owned at some point in our young lives.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
There was no IMDb in freaking early 90s to look up what other movies John Voight had done. You're like, oh, okay. And it's like, you know, maybe an older sibling or your dad or an uncle goes, oh, have you seen Midnight Cowboy? Like that's, or Deliverance. Like they're the movies that immediately pop off the top of people's head, or The Champ. It's maybe still in the video store when you went to God Heat. So yeah, it's, him emerging here, it's like so cool.
Yeah. And also like, if you want to even put more pressure on this performance, it's kind of like, you know, Voight, don't mess this up because this is all kicked back.
Yeah.
This is your ticket back into like some kind of like relevance.
But he carries, you know, this is the funny thing about Voight, right? And, you know, like just reflecting on, he sort of goes into the wilderness, you know, by choice or by publicity stunt, unfortunately, you know, recently. And you look at now, and I think there's a genius in whether it was Mann himself wanted to work with him, and like his casting director, Bonnie Timmerman, who cast this whole movie. There's like an aura of like amazing that comes with John Voight, especially in the 90s. Like you think about those actors, like that trio of performance, like even that duo of performances, like going from Midnight Cowboy to Deliverance, like those movies are such like seminal moment movies. Both instant classics, and you know that at the time that they're made, De Niro is like, that's like De Niro's early career. Like he hasn't, you know, he's only just sort of starting out, 72, like De Niro's biggest movies, you know, comes around then, but he's the young up and comer. Whereas, you know, Voight's already like a full blown movie star by 69. So like he's in the game, he's in that like top tier generation, like a little bit ahead of these guys. So he's kind of got that weird mix of like pure classic movie star, you know, but also in the his contemporaries are, you know, contemporaries with some of De Niro's generation in Hoffman, etc., but not like in it. He's just one step ahead of it.
Yeah, I always kind of view John Voight as just like the alt Robert Redford. Like it's the
same. That's a good point. Yeah, really good point.
It's like if you want to kind of look back at what Hollywood movie stars were kind of at the time, you know, like once Redford arrived and it was like, you know, it was all about the blonde hair and kind of like the handsome kind of good looks. Like Voight is kind of like the old Redford, but he's doing films that are just a little more edgier in a way that like it's just all the stuff that Redford probably said no to. Because I think, you know, if you go back and read any kind of books that cover like Hollywood throughout the 60s and 70s, you cannot read any of these like history books without hitting a story where like Redford is just like in the mix doing things.
Yes.
And something that jumps out. Something that jumps out at me a lot is, you know, just how much power he wielded at the time. And, you know, like he's, you know, nearly every major project that was being developed at the time, it was like number one pick to star in this, Robert Redford, like every single time.
Superman. And like even,
yeah, everything. Like even if you go and read like some of the William Goldman books and like any, you know, anything that kind of is telling these true tales of Hollywood, it's always just like, oh, it's like we came up with this idea and then Robert Redford really wanted to do it and then he didn't want to do it. Like he's just in the mix with everything, which makes you remember that, you know, he was such a huge star. And so then when someone like John Voight comes along, you know, if you couldn't get Redford, then you've got someone like Voight who's kind of a bit of a very similar look, but I'd say kind of, you know, a bit of a rounder face and a bit more kind of like a kind of like, I guess, kind of like country kind of huckster kind of vibe to him,
yes,
which I think so much comes from Midnight Cowboy. But
you know,
yeah,
what's sad, you know, it's devastating though. We're here talking about Deliverance, where he's like the opposite of a country guy, he's a complete city slicker, and you talk about Midnight Cowboy, where he sort of embodies that, like, you know thick middle American strapping big dude,
fresh off the bus,
all those things, and IMDb just spits in our face and says, like, he's an actor known for Anaconda first, like this weird stupid movie, and then it's like Midnight Cowboy second, and then Transformers third, and you're like, Jesus Christ, I hate you, IMDb. Whoever wrote that blurb is just like, no, stop, you need to stop right now, wake up to yourself. All right, Midnight Cowboy and Deliverance first, and then like The Champ, and then nothing else.
Yeah, it's pretty nuts. But, I mean, I guess you can now – I guess he can probably be properly acknowledged now as, like, that second emergence of John Voight after, you know, his kind of peak period and then his, like, resurgence in the 90s. But, yeah, you can definitely start it at Seinfeld and then move through to Heat, and then everything else is just, yeah, his phone ringing again and saying, John Voight
definitely – crushed it in Heat. Come do 10 other things.
Yeah, and by the looks of it, he'd like to work, and I think then, yeah, it all kind of fell apart pretty quickly. But yeah, there's that really great period of him kind of appearing in Heat and having this performance, which I think now, whenever, like I said before, whenever you see this fence type character in a film, because so many filmmakers reference Heat as their favorite when they're kind of doing press for whatever action flick they're rolling out.
Even Solo. Oh, we wanted it to be Heat. Ron Howard, why did you do that? No, you didn't just say that, Ron Howard.
I live on the hill of Solo, where I enjoy my time enjoying that movie. And I have to say, the heist elements of it are very good. When it comes to what he was trying to achieve there. But yeah, I think anyone comparing their film to Heat is insane anyway. So
just
don't
stop.
Even go.
Just that's the first thing I thought is like, why did you do that? That's like a mistake.
Do you know what sucks?
It's a mistake.
Do you know what sucks? You can make the best crime heist thriller ever. Right. And if you say in an interview before I go into the movie, I was really inspired by Heat, the whole time through your movie, I'm just going to be thinking about Heat. I'm just going to be like, how good is Heat? Did you know there's a guy that does a podcast that breaks it down minute by minute? That's how good that movie is. And then I'm like, oh, by the way, I'm supposed to be watching this movie that's supposed to be like Heat, but I can't stop thinking about how good Heat is. When I get home, I'm going to watch Heat. You leave the theater and you go, what movie did I just see? Because I couldn't stop thinking about Heat.
I literally had that reaction. I was like, no, why did you do that? I'm going to be watching going, what about this movie did you think was Heat-like? And then I'm going to dislike it even more. I'm going to be like, even if I didn't like the movie or if I loved it, I'm like, where, you know, what were you doing? Oh, look.
You know what we need to do? We need to get over to the Macquarie Dictionary and the Oxford and all those different dictionaries and say, hey, we got a new thing for you. It's called heat blocking. It's when somebody says their film is like heat and it ruins that movie because you're thinking about heat.
100%. 100%. It's called Den of Thieves. 100%. That movie is a hot garbage. And if you're listening to this episode, you would have already heard that the amazing Katie Walsh, renowned film reviewer, legend who did this show, and I did a special Den of Thieves bonus episode just breaking down the movie. So if you guys want to go back and listen to that, you can hear all of my thoughts. The movie actually hurt me to watch it. It was so bad. It was absolutely the most awful thing ever. It was like having... it was like having a testosterone and steroid shot that, you know, was out of Mickey Rourke's bag from The Wrestler shot up the eye of my dick while I was watching that movie. Like, it was just the worst possible pain one could imagine watching that garbage fire. And Cam, if you haven't seen it.
I haven't seen it, but it does have Jared. It's Jared Butler,
oh
right?
Oh, my God, yes. It's Jared Butler. Right. It's like, it's... You,
the John Voight
actually,
of
action. No, I want you to watch it. I really want someone like you who has fun poking fun at bad movies. Like, just you just have to tell me when you're live tweeting it and I'll check it out and we all can follow along, because I mean it's that bad that I think watching you watch it.
I'll give you a sneak preview. It'll be this. It'll be like, I'm finally doing it. I'm watching Den of Thieves. That's the first tweet. The second tweet will be, man, how good is heat? End thread.
That's it. Ladies and gentlemen, that is the end of my thread, watching Den of Thieves. But yeah, no, it's...
Hashtag heat.
Look, I think heat blocking is amazing. That has to be done. Yeah, just don't talk about it. It would Seriously, be... I'm trying to think of what other movies it would... It is almost like...
Dude, I reckon you could get heat block, like some of the best modern action films, like something like The Dark Knight. If you went into that and someone said, apparently it's inspired by Heat,
movie. You can't watch it.
You can't concentrate. It's just impossible.
Yeah.
It's like, it's like any time anyone puts anything up too high and says it's the best ever or whatever. But I think with Heat in particular, it's just like, Stop. If you're the greatest filmmaker of your time, don't even mention it. And if you're going to mention it, wait at least 10 years until after your film has come out, when the anniversary piece is rolling out. Then you can say, hey, guys.
Really loved Heat. Really loved it. I really loved it. And I was inspired. I used to watch Heat before I did it. I think that's kind of there's like two ways to do it. And it's like, the only other film I could really think of that I have that immediate recall action, you know, that needs a blocking is like Godfather. Because if anyone made a gangster movie, you know, basically from the 70s all the way to 1990, because Goodfellas was like a new leaf
a
completely different energy that sort of overcame like a lot of the baggage that had happened, because people were just trying, like, so intimidated and in awe of the Godfather. They were just trying to make these, you know, these ciphers of it, and they were just all ghastly. And so then you get to something like The Sopranos, where that's in the consciousness and they just run straight towards it. Like, they just run straight towards that, like, the Godfather, like, the guys do the quotes and they talk all the shit and, you know, they talk about what they would have done or not done, and it's just in their lives. It's in the lexicon of the show. So, it's like but exactly to your point, you have to do it with enough distance that it's just gone. Otherwise you can't do it. But, like, yeah, there's just, you just shouldn't do it. And I think Spielberg does it right too, where he says before he goes on any project, he watches the same, you know, couple of David Lean movies. He'll watch like a Lawrence of Arabia, Bridge Over the River Kwai, and something. He watches something else. I don't know if it's like The Searchers, or even Scorsese says usually watches The Searchers before he starts any movie. He's like, there's sort of a few that, like, they just say, I watch this movie all the time because it inspires me, but they don't like say that how that's specifically going to impact the way that they're undertaking it.
Trying to think of a film that recent interview that real like anything that you read before a film that just really annoyed me in terms of like putting a film in context. I think the directors that do it the worst, and this is a public service announcement if you're making a horror film in the next 12 months to not do this, which is to contextualize your horror film by just referencing like six horror films.
Yes.
But then each one is so eclectic that it just blows everybody's mind. So you go, oh, it's kind of like Rosemary's Baby and A Nightmare on Elm Street and Get Out and Night of the Living Dead. And then it's just so painful. So, yeah, but I think of all the films to do it with the worst, I think it definitely is Heat, because it just smothers whatever people are trying to achieve. So it's one of those very rare films that lives in that territory where even just a mere mention of it will
just kills many movies. I'm so glad, like, I did a podcast with the guys from the Cinephiles, you know, about, I think it's around 60 episodes back, a couple of them. And at the time, one of the hosts, Josh, had never heard about the Dark Knight Heat thing, and just said that the next time that he'd watched, he obviously watching Heat in preparation for the show, he then went back and watched The Dark Knight, and he was completely changed forever. He was like, I can't watch The Dark Knight anymore. It's just Heat. I just sit there going like, you know, drawing the dots and going like, oh my God, this is just Heat. It's just Heat and Heat and Heat and Heat.
Congratulations, buddy. You got Heat blocked.
Oh, you're Heat blocked. That's good. I like Heat blocked. We're going to that. I think this episode might have a subtitle, one of the first ever called Heat blocked. I think that's what it needs. But yeah, no, this is, it's, you're getting Heat blocked so hard. If you say it, if any director, just stop, just don't say it. I don't care if you watched every frame of Heat to like inspire you, much like Rian Johnson did with Brick, and like he watched, you know, Maltese Falcon and stuff like that, and, you know, incorporated and sort of like did Maltese Falcon through the, you know, the lens of a, you know, middle American high school. Like that's okay. Like you can talk about that after it's released, but you can't ever say Heat first. You can't. It's over.
Heat. Don't Heat first. Never Heat first. it's one of those things. But, hey, the only other thing that jumped out at me at this scene is it just me, or is the plan to get Macaulay out of the country more complex than anything they've done in this film?
Well, this is the thing. I think all of Neil's plans are really complex. And, like, John Voight is in this scene when he's saying it. It's like, I had to kill this. We've called this guy. And you're like, you're just like, yes. I sometimes like complex, you know, you being a film fan, like, and you and I watch a lot of movies and lots of TV shows. And sometimes the oversimplification, like, and I think of like, it's like the Jason Bourne thing where like he walks up to a motorbike and he like just taps it once and it starts. And you're like, yep. How did that start? Like, how did you do that? Like, yeah. And for me, I sometimes like when things are done over in detail. The comedian Tony Martin always talks about that same phenomena, and he talks about it being really great in Midnight Run, another movie with Robert De Niro, and Charles Grodin, an incredible buddy comedy, I shouldn't say, not buddy cop comedy, but it's a buddy comedy on the run. De Niro steals a car in that movie, and like he, you know, breaks open where the ignition is, and he does a few things and pulls this down and gets this wire and it sparks like spark. And it's one of those rare examples where you're like, oh, I'm actually watching him do what someone would have to do to steal this car. And so I kind of like it in this moment, because it's like, you know, where I need to tell you about the plane. I need to tell you about the call sign. I need to tell you about this. I need to tell you about that. And you can sort of see De Niro frantically like, all right, taking a few notes or whatever he's doing on a piece of paper. Just like, yep, logging all this down. I need to know. But it's like, yeah, of course Neil's plans are all in detail. You know, he's there the night before taking it all out.
Do you know what De Niro does in this scene? He does that thing that I'm always in awe of at waiters at restaurants, where they remember your order without writing it down, because it's so complex. Like, I was actually thinking, because there's a bit in the plan where the plane will only wait for a certain amount of time, and I'm just like, planes can't just be waiting out on tarmac. They have to be either moving or taking off, otherwise they're going to smash into each other. So that's what I got, for the first time ever.
How much fear do you have when they're doing it? I have a lot. It gives me lots of anxiety. I'm just like, can you fucking please write this down? Like, even if it's not that complicated. My coffee order is pretty complicated sometimes. I'm like, hey, can I have a long black with a dollop of cream, like real cream, not milk? And they're like, yep. And I'm like, cool. I guess I'm getting a flat white, because that's definitely not remembering.
That's what's going to happen, man. That's what's going to happen. Yeah, maybe everyone in Heat, and we do know that there's a Heat prequel coming out, maybe that prequel would just be like them all working in the service industry and like how they develop like super memories to remember all these complex plans by like working in a restaurant together and like just being kick-ass waiters at remembering things.
Hold on one second. I think he's writing it down.
Does he write anything down?
I think he is. Like, so if we're looking at, if you're at 19 seconds, oh, wait. I think you can freeze frame. No, I think we can freeze frame. I think you're going to see that he's writing it down. So just as Neil whips around from Nate when he spots the car, he's writing on an envelope. There's a manila envelope in his hand. And so it's either written down for him or he's writing it down. And so here, see, there's like he lifts his hands up slightly, he turns around, and then he goes back. And that's when Nate's talking now. He's looking at him, and he is writing it down. So it's not...
He is writing it down. God damn it.
We've Eddie debunked your theory that he's just remembering it. Because, his memory would be too good. But no, that does give me anxiety. I'm really being serious right now. Please write things down.
I was really looking forward to that restaurant pericle where they're all in a thing together.
Well, look, Reed Coleman and Michael Mann are the authors of the Heat prequel. We don't know what it's called yet. Other than it's called The Heat Prequel, and it's being released by Michael Mann Books sometime later in the year. So you guys listening to this in March, apparently, you know, July, August, American summertime. So we're in the fall, a little bit after that. So September, etc. So, and you know, we're going to find out. We might meet these two guys again in that prequel and figure out like just how awesome Nate is, or he might get in the nitty gritty and watch Nate make some mistakes or watch Nate in a heist or something like that. We never know. Nate might get himself in some trouble and know some of these guys and expand this thing. Let's see where they go with this bad boy.
Yeah, that's definitely, I think Nate definitely is what, like if you were to say, oh, you can only include three characters in this prequel, who's got to appear? I think Nate definitely has to be in there in some capacity. Yeah. And also too, see that character expand out a little bit more and spend more time with him and kind of figure out why he decides to go with the mustache and mullet combo. I think that definitely needs to be explained.
There's three chapters just on the hair choice. Look, it's a strong mullet mo game, and so influential that it even influenced Colin Farrell later on in Miami Vice, and people were so distracted. I'm like, look, this is just Nate. He's just killing it with a Nate do. Like, what is everyone so stressed about? He's absolutely killing the game right now.
I mean, that's how you know his character is not to be messed with, because he's pulling off that look and nobody is questioning it. That's not even worth a mention. You know. Yeah. I mean, Blake, it's free country, brother.
Well, look, in that spirit, Cam Williams, thank you so much, mate, for being a part of One Heat Minute. Thank you for your support and encouragement at minute 133. If we don't get to see you before this end run as we're ramping up to the final finish line, mate, thank you so much for being a part of the show, and thank you for your huge contribution. 109 episodes, 110 episodes ago was your first episode that you're on it. So thank you so much for being here. So, like, you know, again, you talk about it being the longest movie ever. It does. When I speak to you for the first time again, not in the world, but on this show, 110 episodes, 109 episodes, it's pretty scary.
It's a long time between Heat Minutes, I'll tell you that. So
it's a long time.
I think that's going to become a thing now. It's going to become like people saying that because the ability for you to take this film and make people think even deeper about it 1 minute at a time is incredible. So even just doing this episode and watching this scene, you know, again, reminded me, you know, just what this podcast is doing and how it's making people think about films in general. So, thank you so much for having me on.
Mate, you're welcome. Guys, at Mr. Cam W is the best place to find Cam Williams. You can read sort of his back catalog of stuff. He usually keeps it all like a resume on his classic, thepopcornjunkie.com. But you can see him and hear from him there, and he'll bounce off to a bunch of things. Cam's currently, thank you, Cam, recommended One Heat Minute on a great birth, movies, death piece. And I see that he's back talking about Finding Drago, which I hadn't heard of until I was scouring his Twitter very recently. So I'm like insanely excited about that prospect of that podcast, the serial for Rocky fans. So Finding Drago looks like my next one.
Yeah, look, if you end up listening to Finding Drago and you can find out a way to get Todd Noy on the show to talk about Heat, that will probably be the most listened to podcast of all time. So I definitely think, it's such an author of noise. I mean, I'm just getting emotional thinking about it, but to have Noy on Heat would be incredible. So I highly recommend tracking down that podcast if you've got the time. It's only like 7 episodes, so you can easily knock it over.
That is 100% done. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you again for listening to One Heat Minute. I've been your host, Blake Howard. Thank you to Mr. Garth Franklin for our web design, Mr. Paul Davies for our awesome theme, and as always, thank you everyone who's subscribed and rated and reviewed and commented and flicked us notes on Twitter or from our inbox at mail@oneheatminute.com. Thank you. Keep doing that. Can't wait to keep reading them and periodically, as I did recently with the most recent one I did with Oscar Hillestrom, did a bit of a mailbag for One Heat Minute before we kicked off the minute. So as more stuff piles in, I definitely do read it and keen to share it with everyone because it's just some great stuff that you guys have been hitting me up with. mail@oneheatminute.com for everything else. And look, we'll catch you on another episode of One Heat Minute just around the corner. Remember, it's a free country.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Synovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at synovus.com.